Today's program has been brought to you by GreatBrewers.com, a social media marketing platform dedicated to promoting the world's great brewers and the beers they create. For more information, visit GreatBrewers.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Word of Mouth with Lady Sue.
From Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to Word of Mouth with Lady Sue at heritageradionetwork.org. You can also download and listen through iTunes or Stitcher. I'm your host, Lady Sue. And what do I do when I'm not hosting Word of Mouth? I'm taking long walks in the snow. It's snowing out. It's cold. I'm out and abouting, having the very conversations that you hear on my show, and working with chefs and sommeliers, big brands and startups, those doing all what's most delicious and innovative. Today's live in studio guests later on will welcome hashtag people we like, Chef John Daly, a Masa and 15 East alum who just opened up this summer his very own 11-seater spot in the Lower East Side. We'll talk about a little in depth, than, you know, him landing in GQ and the New York Times. He's been called the sushi bro. He's that really tall white guy who makes inventive sushi. I'm changing things up this week because it's my show and I can do whatever I want. So what do I want? All the time, every day? Taiwanese food. A little birdie told me that Matt Gross, web editor at Bon Appetit, has landed in Taiwan and is eating danbing and paigu fan and hong sao niu rou mian, and I just had to squeeze him in. So we've got Matt on the line. Hey, Matt.
Hey there.
Hey, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. So it's like 11 p.m. there, right?
Yes.
So this morning I was like, how many brain cells is it going to take for me to locate an international calling card? So old school. So Matt, a little bit about him. He was the Frugal Traveler columnist for the New York Times. Now he's at Bon Appetit. You just published a book, right?
Yeah, I did. The Turk Who Loved Apples and Other Tales of Losing My Way Around the World.
I can't wait to pick it up.
Sure. Go grab it.
How many countries have you been to?
50 or 60. At a certain point, you stop sort of counting. Or I guess at a certain point, you start really, really counting. But 50 or 60.
So I'm always telling my friends from this country and also from mainland China that Taiwanese food trumps it all. So it's like, so it's salve to my soul to hear it from a white guy. So why is Taiwanese food so incredible?
Oh, man, Taiwanese food is sort of every different kind of Chinese food that you can imagine. You have your Sichuan spicy food, your northern Beijing dumpling food, your southern Guangdong seafood, all of that stuff, everything from every little part of China, plus its own sort of Taiwanese cuisine, which is heavy on, all those inner organs that we love, kidneys and intestines and all that good stuff. A lot of dumplings and noodles, and there's a dedication here to eating that makes things just extra good. When people are, you know, eating seven times a day, as people seem to do here, they make sure their food is good. The Japanese colonized this island for about 50 years, so there's a huge Japanese influence. So, I don't know, if you have all of Japan and all of China and bonus cuisine in one place, that's this little island.
It's super obsessive. I mean, you mentioned how a story about the fabric market.
a few years ago I was here in Taipei with my wife, who's Taiwanese, and we were walking through a fabric market, and it was like, yeah, here's a silk stall, and here's a button stall, and then here's a fishbowl shop, and then here's a canvas store, and then here's a noodle shop. And it was like, and that's normal. Every little place here has something that's just all about food. Every little town that may be famous for its hot springs or some, you know, 300-year-old quasi-Buddhist site, just is really popular because there's a great street that's full of, I don't know, stinky tofu stalls, or here's a town that's famous for its sushi chefs. Everybody here is a whiz with a knife. It's just sort of normal. Everything revolves around food. Starts in food and comes back to food.
It's like, of course, I have to, eat something when I'm shopping for fabric or when I'm touring the, natural wonders of Taiwan.
Yeah, of course. Why would you go otherwise? If you can't get, a good bowl of dumplings along the way, then why would you leave the house in the first place?
And, the other influences, the tropical fruit and produce, it's, so... The mangoes in Taiwan are like mangoes on crack. They're like the Hulk mangoes. And, maybe in your research, and you've written about Taiwan for major publications, I heard the revolutionary Chiang Kai-shek, who fled from China to Taiwan, was a, shall we say, foodie. And so he brought all the best chefs. And and one of the first five economic tigers of Asia to become prosperous was Taiwan, in addition to others like Singapore. So it's sort of like there's this, I'm trying to go for a moment in depth about why it's such a big part of the Taiwanese psyche. Like we maybe had the privilege of being able to eat food for more than sustenance more quickly than perhaps the rest of China. I just made Taiwan part of
definitely.
China. I didn't mean to do that.
I mean, there's a theory here as well. When Chiang Kai-shek was around, the island was actually under martial law for about 40 years, from 47 to, 87, 89? And so one of the theories goes that because martial law was in effect and people were, there wasn't a lot of political freedom at the time, people had to channel their energies into other things. If they couldn't form political parties and get active that way, then they turned to food. So they ate and they developed a kind of amazing cuisine. And I like that theory. I don't know if it holds true, because since 1989 and the coming of full democracy to this island, democracy has flourished in completely amazing ways. There's no more politically active democratic island in Asia, and yet, at the same time, cuisine has flourished alongside it. So I don't know if political repression leads to culinary expansion, or if they go hand in hand, or if there's just something about this island where people keep wanting to eat and eat interesting things.
Wow. So we're going to... This is a preview for an upcoming show where Matt will be with me in the studio, because we had too much to talk about, so I had to invite him into the studio. But so now... This moment in time, what have you eaten so far, and what's on your short list to check out this trip?
Let's see. I think the first thing that I ate right off the plane? We came back here to my wife's family's house and just had some sort of takeout late-night noodles. Just simple noodles. I think it was ganmian. It was basically very simple noodles dressed in... Luro, which is a sort of ground pork stewed with soy sauce and five spice powder and sort of various aromatic things, shallots and dried shrimp. It's just the absolute most basic thing. Cheap noodles, cheapest cut of pork ground up and cooked for a long time with cheap spices, and it's incredibly flavorful and so easy and comforting. That was something that I had been on the plane just wanting to eat. One of the absolute cheapest, simplest things that you can get. This is a very Taiwanese kind of thing. Cuisine of poverty kind of dish. After that, various noodle dishes. This one dish that's a favorite of my wife's called Nianxian or Amishuo, which is traditionally called oyster noodles, although they don't often have oysters in them anymore. Very short, thin wheat noodles in what you kind of have to describe it as a viscous broth. If you're not used to thicker soups and stranger textures, then Taiwan will be an eye opener for you. But this is this just wonderful bucket of thin noodles and thick broth with nuggets of intestine and a lot of garlic and black vinegar and chilies and cilantro. It's super, super powerful flavors with this underlying strong, warm noodle soup.
powerful yet comforting. And when you are lucky enough to get those this noodle soup studded with oysters, they're like these tiny sweeter oysters that are just different from the oysters that you get anywhere else.
Oh yeah, you know, I actually remember on another trip to Taiwan, I asked for this same dish that I'd had a million times, but I was on this little tiny island called Jinlan, which is actually, it's part of Taiwan, but it's closer to mainland China. And what came out was so totally different. It was like much longer, stringier noodles and tons of little oysters in it as well, and like some fresh vegetables. It was totally bizarre. It was almost unrecognizably different, but it was sort of at heart the same thing, that warm, slithery noodles and the oysters. And it was really great.
So a short list to check out, and we're going to, I'm like so looking forward to catching up with you on your post, your post recap. So short list.
My short list of where to eat here in Taiwan?
What to check out this time around? You've been so many times, you know, you're...
Oh, man. That's the hard part. Whenever you go back to a place that you love and love to eat in it, you want to hit all the places that are old favorites, but you want to hit some new ones, too. An old favorite that I'm definitely going to get to is a place called James Kitchen. It is a Taiwanese adaptation of a Japanese izakaya.
Mm-hmm.
You get those great Japanese grilled mackerels and grilled oily fishes, perfectly seared on the skin side, served with some lemon or yuzu and some ground yam. They'll do that thing right next to a stew of intestines, just super, super stinky and flavorful and gut-bomby. That's what I love, is the integration of these two very different kinds of eating. And, of course, you do it by revolving everything around beer and sake, which makes disparate foods go together very well. So that's one thing that's on my must-try list this trip. And then for new stuff, there's a bunch of cool new classic cocktail bars here, founded by a lot of people from Ireland and Taiwanese people who've worked in Ireland and New York, who are doing, you know, serious high-end cocktails out of the cocktail encyclopedias, all those 19th century manuals that everybody in New York and L.A. and San Francisco is making their cocktails with. So I'm psyched to try those. That's a kind of a new phenomenon for Taiwan.
Thank you.
Let's see, I'll give you one.
One more. Quick one.
Which is my wife's family's apartment is in a neighborhood called Ximending, which is very youth oriented. It's like if you're 14 years old, 15 years old, and you want somewhere to hang out, this is the neighborhood you go to. So it's full of all these flashy, bright, trendy, and cheap kind of clothing stores and eateries too. And I don't know why, but since our last trip here about a year and a half ago, it's become colonized by tons of mango shaved ice places. I don't know why they weren't in this neighborhood before, but all of a sudden you walk down a couple streets and there's lots of shaved ice and mango shops. So that's what I'm going to be eating pretty soon. Shaved ice covered with chunks of mango and mango sauce and mango ice cream.
Ximending is like...
Sorry, Leite.
It's like Taiwan...
Can't bring it back.
It's like, it's to sum it up, and it's like Times Square, but with like, way better food.
And cooler people.
And cooler... cooler people. Like, people are like zooming, you know, focused on getting to that next food stall, so we like those people. So thank you so much, Matt, for joining us.
Sure thing. It's been great talking with you, and your listeners can follow my Taiwan eating adventures on my Instagram account.
On Instagram, I have it here, @worldmatt.
Yep, World Matt, that's me.
And then on Twitter, though, he's World Matt World, which will throw you for a loop.
Yeah, some Swiss guy stole World Matt on Twitter, so I have to be World Matt World on Twitter and World Matt on Instagram.
He doesn't even know you're way more world than he is.
You know, he started that account, and he didn't even use it for a few years, and by the time I signed up, and it's okay.
Cool. Thank you so much, and catch you later. Happy eating.
Yeah, it's been great talking to you.
Envious. Bye. So that's a preview for my Tuesday 12/3, December 3rd show, when Matt's coming into the studio. We're going to get to know him a lot more and get the recap. So you see, I told you, social media is super duper. As I found out about his adventures in Taiwan because he tweeted. Speaking of social media, tell us what you think. You heard his handles. Talk to us, hashtag WOMSHOW, WOMSHOW. I'm at Leitishu, LEITISHU on both Instagram and Twitter. And you can also find Heritage Radio at Heritage_Radio on Instagram and Twitter. Matt works for Bon Appetit at Bon Appetit on Twitter. And now for People We Like. Chef John Daly, a Masa and 15 East alum, and he also did a stint in Tokyo, this summer opened up his own 11-seater spot, a tiny spot in the Lower East Side. I'm so happy for you. Welcome.
Good morning, and thank you.
I can't believe you have your own spot now. I first met you many years ago at 15 East. I love Masato Shimizu's sushi, and you were that tall white guy next to the diminutive Japanese fellow that is Masato. By the way, FYI, we say Masa and Masato. We call Masato Masa short, and don't get it confused with Masa, the other sushi restaurant. Yeah. So then, you know, you were the guy who massaged the octopus 500 times in order to then poach it to make pretty much the best octopus I've ever had in my life in the world. And I'm, you know, have way more to try, but it's incredible to go have that at New York Sushi Co. or at 15 East. All right, so let's paint the picture. How tall are you?
Approximately 6'1", 6'2".
Okay, on a good day. And then he's got, like, sleeves of tattoos. He's, like, the most un-Japanese-looking person, you know, ever. When did you think, all right, it's time to start my own place?
You know, I believe it's every chef's goal to have their own restaurant, or at least their own spot. And I don't know too many chefs that wouldn't want to interface with their guests on such an intimate level, like that we've created at New York Sushi Co. All food aspects, be it, you know, hot foods, you know, kaiseki or even sushi. So it's pretty much since I've seen somebody's delight from eating food that I either created from my imagination or from a chef's menu. And when the first time you're shown that, it kind of strikes you. You see it differently than the happy chef who got his food out to the runner to the table. You know, you actually see the instant reaction. So I'd say probably the first time I saw that was in Time Warner Masa in 2005 when after a 1 a.m. jazz show let out. The dining room had filled up after the kitchen was closed, and, you know, in a time span of 10 minutes, the board was full, and what was a beautiful, clean kitchen about to be walked out of was now the bustling hub of the evening again. So as soon as the last plates went out and the ticket was cleared, Masa from Time Warner, Yoshimasa Takeyama, I believe his name is. Please don't kill me if I got your name wrong, chef. He pretty much, you know, kind of grabbed me by the ear. And he goes, look at that, you know, and I'm looking, and, you know, yeah, chef, I don't know what to look for, you know, and he points, you know, because it's something I've never seen before, and he shows me, he goes, look at them, they're happy because of the food you made, they're happy because of your food, you know, my all Japanese self, I'm like, no, chef, it's your food, and he goes, no, you made it, they're happy because of you, you know, and he gave me literally like 30 seconds to bask in it, and then go clean up, so.
Wow.
Yeah. So probably 2005 was when I was like, I need to have my own spot that I can, you know, deliver my message of food into my audience.
It is quite an audience. It's quite a show, and I've been really spoiled. I mean, on Sunday, John did a dinner party for a mutual friend, Susan. Thank you, Susan. Shout out. And then yesterday I had the pleasure of doing some quote unquote research, came into the restaurant and tried some of these dishes we're about to talk about. And what's beautiful about today in this world is that no longer is, you know, inventive like sushi grade fish arranged daintily on a plate and soaked in ponzu sauce. And then we call that something that's, you know, inventive. Your dishes are way crazy fun. So give us you're using stuff as ordinary as a hand blender, a chinois, you're blowtorching stuff left and right, and I don't mind it because it tastes good. So tell us about a couple of your signature dishes.
So, I mean, there's probably two that stand out in my mind that would be, like, you know, signature dishes where, like, I could probably say, the genesis of the creation to, you know, execution on the plate.
Mm-hmm.
Came with, you know, of course, influence, but, you know, from myself, from where I wanted to take food. And that would be either, hotote with the uni sauce and yuzu foam, or the toro tartare. The hotote is a sea scallop, or hotate.
Thank you. I was just...
I know. It happens. It happens. That's the white guy in me. You know, anyway, like I said last night, we got scallops, you know, so some scallops with an uni sauce. Usually the uni sauce is derived from just pressing California uni or Murasaki sea urchin through a sieve and just collecting or yielding the just the bounty that falls or drips from it, and that's just collected as uni sauce. We then place scallops on top, and then with a simple yuzu foam made from egg whites. I feel that for Japanese food, or at least sushi, if you're going to adulterate it in any means, any ways, you know, adulterate it with, you know, the utmost integrity. You know, don't bring in extra ingredients. Don't bring in, you know, things that weren't, don't bring in, you know, food items that, or even food instruments that weren't available in the spectrum of food, you know, 200 years ago. So it's like, here we have an egg, and yeah, I speed the process up by using a hand mixer, but, you know, I could mix it with a whisk in my wrist. You know, that's no problem, but, you know, we have to save time.
It also looks, it's just fun.
And exactly, it's a fun dish, it's a fun presentation. And I feel I break no rules that bind me by traditional flavors and ingredients, but yet I get to just have fun and just break the mold out of what we're used to seeing and used to eating.
And by the way, it's just, you know, the whole going back, you know, to only using stuff that was available 200 years ago, but modern sushi has only been around since like 50 years ago. So it's just, you know, and it's just kind of funny that's the case.
Yeah, well, it's really weird. I know it sounds odd, and there may be many tweets or whatnot in response to this one, but when I hold my like old world Japanese knives, like I'm like transported.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the old wooden handles differently than like if I grab like a Western style knife. You know, it doesn't take me to a place. It makes me want to cook. It makes me want to chop. It makes me want to, you know, perform in a kitchen. But like I can literally feel transported when I grab one of my Japanese knives.
Mm-hmm. So there are some things, you know, still worth going to the old school stuff, and there are some things worth changing up.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to mention the dish that you serve this hotate and uni jiu in, which when I came in yesterday, I, as maybe somebody who's used to slurping noodles and soup, and I pick up the bowl and I just, you know, put it to my mouth and I drink the rest of it. Even though the dish is very, very shallow, I naturally had that inclination, and that dish is what made in Brooklyn, and it has a little spout so that you can do that, even though it's drinking from a plate.
Yeah, and so I like interacting with your food. It's fun to play with your food. You know, many people talk about eating food with your hands and just get involved. So the plates were designed, you know, collaboration between Helen Levy, a ceramicist located here in Brooklyn, who does amazing work, and I believe has been, I'm just going to plug her for a second.
Totally. You can plug whatever you want.
Been picked up by West Elm, I believe, since since a little bit of coverage of New York Sushi Co. and about her ceramics being featured there. But so during the menu design and the recipe testing, she was involved because plates are an integral part of plating food, you know, and recipe design. So there's the final execution of how are we going to deliver? We have this message now. How are we going to deliver it? And it came to the point where some of these plates need to have that slurpability, you know, and a lot of the first two courses at New York Sushi Co. are almost profiling dishes for me to see where the customer's at. how they approach their food.
So I'll
tell you this one. We put down a small fork, you know, and chopsticks for first course. And now you could even just pick up first course and slurp it. So, and it's a lot, and a lot of times I see, you know, how they interact with their food. Are they afraid? Are they hesitant? Do they grab the chopsticks? Do they grab the fork? You know, are they eating for themselves or are they eating for the group? You know, so there's a lot of things to take into consideration. And then the moment you kind of get a fix on the guest is how you can move forward with the omakase. There's no fixed menu. If I'll have a party of two, get a five-course omakase, and a party next to them, get a five-course omakase, the only courses that'll resemble each other will be the sushi courses. Other than that, I mean, I have four courses to just have fun with these people now.
Oh my gosh! I remember when I read the the history of sushi. I actually forget the author's name. Do you Trevor Corson?
The gentleman from Jules Bocco.
Well, there was a book, and
he wrote a book.
Oh, he actually is part of Jules Bocco.
I know that there's another Caucasian gentleman. it was maybe about 10 years my senior. His name completely escapes me, but I believe it is Trevor Corson.
Okay.
Because I'm familiar with that book, and he's a very knowledgeable man on sushi and sake, who is the dinner concierge.
We are talking about the same guy. When I read this book on the history of sushi, it really like wrecked me, by the way, because I had to order Kanoyama's omakase dinner entree all the time, every day. Like every day I had to have sushi. It really wrecked me. I wanted to mention, it's just a fabulous book.
Yes, I certainly support her. The moment I found that book and I knew of who Trevor Corson was, I was actually unemployed at the time, and I sent him an email. I was like, do you need an assistant? I was like, you seem to be so closely associated not only in your heart, but in your day-to-day movings of sushi. And to find that in New York is an absolute beautiful thing. There was nothing better for me than going to Tokyo and living in Tokyo and working in Tokyo allows you to work at Tsukiji Market as a chef. And something that happens at Tsukiji Market that movies like Jiro Dreams of Sushi overlooks, or Sushi Global Catch overlooks, and even a 1 or 2 hour visit to Tsukiji you won't be able to see, is there's a sense of community that Tsukiji Market offers the entire chefing community in Tokyo. So every day, every chef sees each other. If the market's open, you're going to be shopping for your produce there. So it's kind of like, hey, that guy's getting here at 7:30. Oh, that guy's getting here at 8. You know, we've been here since 6:30 shopping. You know, so you get to see who's working, what they're buying. You know, how and even how hard they work, how devoted to their craft they are. It's a lot different than and it's also a level playing field. We're all seeing each other shopping. You know, it's not like there's nothing in New York that really offers that. There's an unspoken sense of humility. Like, I'm entering your restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
So for me to interact with another chef, I have to go to their restaurant. They have to come into mine. You're automatically someone's guest at that point in time, where you can be your own person and not be a guest in someone else's restaurant. You know, because if you go to another chef's restaurant, you should be a guest. You shouldn't go there as a chef.
Mm-hmm,
you know, but at Tsukiji Market, two chefs can be two chefs.
Oh, that's so
cool. And talk to each other, and you see every chef. So even day one, I saw Jiro Ono's son, you know, and the Jiro team, the Sushiko team, and then the Mizutani team. You know, this is all, and this.
This sounds like a cheer competition.
Yeah, right. Pretty much. The things I listed were all three Michelin star sushi bars in Tokyo, and if your heart is in sushi, you've heard these names before. If you've been lucky enough to eat their food, you've eaten their food. It's like
mind blowing.
It's definitely mind blowing. It's like going to Union Square Market and seeing Danielle, John George, and Wiley all in the same shot. You know, you're like, are you guys serious? Like, what are you guys all doing here? You know, it'd be like wow. It'd be like as if the menu is all this chef team for Push went shopping at Key Foods or something one day. You're like, what are you doing here?
Yeah, Push project at MPON. John's envious and
so envious. Are you kidding me? If that happens again, I'm closing my restaurant, chef. Yeah,
Alex Dupac, you hear that? John's coming to the next Push. Well, the Pushes are always pretty epic, and this one was like, I guess, the most outrageously epic because it was Grant Atkatz and that whole team, and then Alex Dupac, and then Wiley Dufresne, and then, you know, Thomas Keller was dining in the Jimmy dining room. Ooh, we're so lucky. I had Chef Pet, Sule Pet Schwader from Kia in the studio last week, and that is a Laotian guy doing Laotian food. And now, you know, we had a white guy talking Taiwanese food. Now we got a white guy talking or executing masterful sushi, which is a very obsessive thing. So the press is gobbling you up, which I'm like jazzed about, you know, that's awesome. And you've been called the sushi bro by...
I've been called a lot of things lately.
A lot of things by Alan Richman. Always a fun guy to read. I once took a class, studied under him, so hi, Alan. I would shout out his Twitter, because I don't think he's on Twitter. the press is covering you, but in the kitchen, it's been another story. Maybe, like, you were that one round eye who, like, wanted to, like, what the hell are you doing here? Did you get any of that kind of skepticism?
I don't think the skepticism stops. Sushi bar has been open 24 weeks now. I've been the only chef behind the counter, unless there was a, you know, for some reason there was one of the servers behind the counter. Essentially, anyone who stood behind that counter has been Caucasian, not been Japanese or Chinese, Korean, or Asian of descent. And, you know, people know this from you know, online publications and whatnot and links. And there's still an utter look of shock when people walk in the door. You know, like, huh? Like,
they're like, can we talk to the chef, please?
One of those whole things. I mean, it's not as bad as when I was covering for Masato at 15 East, when he would go on vacation during my last year of training at 15 East. I would fill in his position on Mondays when he would take off or on vacation. And there was nothing that kind of broke my heart more. I mean, it's not even, like, I wouldn't even get mad. You know, but, like, my heart would literally break when people would walk in the door, see that it wasn't Masa, and then turn around and leave. Like, literally. Or be like, this white guy, and turn around and leave. Or go, you know what? I'll suffer through the sushi, but I'm going to eat it in the dining room. And, you know, it's just one of those whole, like, can we all be open-minded? You know, please, you know, like, be open-minded with what we eat. Be open-minded with who serves it to us. I mean, as I believe there's an old saying, it's, you know, don't kill the messenger sort of thing, you know, but the press has been surreal. It certainly doesn't, I've never been one for that, you know, like, it's, I...
Well, get over it, because
I mean,
you're fabulous now.
Food, oh, baby, come on. No, I mean, food sells food, you know, and I think word of mouth, not only this show, but word of mouth in this town also sells food and creates great restaurants alongside of great chefs and great staff. You know, it's a unilateral, multilateral, you know, it takes a village to raise a child. You know, New York Sushi Co, you know, it's my child, and, you know, I'm just asking the village for help, you know.
Every little bit helps.
Yeah.
Because it's tough going, having a restaurant. So after a very quick commercial break, we're going to talk to John about how he messed up his interview with April Bloomfield, why getting fired is a good thing, and just a quick go back in time where he's from, the great New Jersey.
You are listening to Loveless Child by Shadowbox on the heritageradionetwork.org. On the scale.
you want to taste the finest beer and spirits from over 125 breweries and 30 distilleries? The Craft Experience, the most exclusive craft and spirit tasting event in New York, hosted by great brewers, is available to the public for the first time ever. Join your fellow beer and spirit enthusiasts on Wednesday, November 13th in Manhattan to mingle with the superstars of the craft beverage world. Tickets are available now at www.thecraftexp.com.
Welcome back to the studio. You're listening to Word of Mouth with Leyte Su. I'm Leyte Su, and in the studio today, we have Chef John from New York Sushi Co. Chef John from New York Sushi Co. And he's going to tell us about the only interview he's ever messed up. Right?
Yeah, I suppose so. So I wouldn't even say messing up, because the old, one door closes, a couple windows open sort of thing. So a friend of mine got me a trail at Spotted Pig before they had the second floor, and when they still had the original Nudie on the dish, and it was an amazing opportunity for me, because I was really excited about working in April Bloomfield's One Michelin Starred Kitchen, and also learning the Nudie dish. And so I had a trail set up for a Friday. I was just in the neighborhood with my knives on Thursday. Stopped in to do the trail then to a very surprised chef. And so she was almost hesitant or resistant, but she said, okay, fine. Come trail, get changed. Got changed, began doing some chopping, some cutting, some small, mini net of shallots. And then I got a text from a friend of mine that I had a cheese tasting set up with. I was just a little young scrote in the kitchens and stuff, so I was trying to learn everything I could. Cheese tastings, wine tastings, this and that, like on days off, and especially being unemployed, you have free time that you don't have when you're cooking to do these things. I found myself sending a text message to my friend saying, hey, I'm going to cancel this this cheese tasting today. I've got a trail at Spotted Pig I'm really excited about, and I'd like to just go through with the trail. I get back inside from sending literally that text message, not even smoking a cigarette or getting high or anything, and I literally heard this phrase, pack up your knives, take care.
I love it.
Couldn't believe it. Like, my jaw dropped, and I was like, wow, sure. It's one of those situations where you don't even ask why, and if someone's ever going to be that curt with you, there's no reason to ask why. And it's really funny, because literally about 2 days later, I got hired at Masa. So it's one of those whole, like kind of a blessing, because if I, I was working, modern American cuisine, Italian, and, kind of like a take on French cuisine for, for a few years before Masa. So Spotted Pig probably would have, kept pushing me in that, European or Western direction. I'm really glad.
Wow, that's incredible.
So thank you, April.
Wow. April, you're rad. So getting fired is also a good thing.
Yes.
So what happened there?
So getting fired is a good thing sometimes. Well, it builds character. Mm-hmm.
But what happened at Del Pasto?
So I started cooking because you didn't have to be at work till 3 or 4 in the afternoon. Then eventually you get a real job, and it's like, hey, guess what? Now you have to be at work at 10 a.m. So Maso is working from 10 a.m. to 1 a.m., 10 a.m. to 1 a.m. After leaving Masa, I was afforded the opportunity to work with the Vitali family, Bastianich and Ladner team, under the graces of Kevin Garcia, who walked me into that world. And I was involved in the opening of Del Pozo before Del Pozo was opening. I really wanted to be a part of the team, so there was someone who had left Babbo, so I was working at Babbo in the evenings and doing the menu and the recipe testing at Del Pozo in the mornings, which I could not make it to. Not because I was overworked, but because I was just a young turd, and I would go out at night, and I would just really not take shit as seriously as I should. But in my heart, I took everything very seriously. Like, if I was late in a taxi or late on a train, I would be like, what the fuck am I doing right now, and then it was kind of, just an eye-opening, awakening experience where it's like, hey, John, you can't behave like this. You know, here's a great opportunity that you're being allowed, and you fucked it up.
Yeah.
You know, so we asked you to leave, and I was the first person fired from Del Posa before it even opened.
Wow.
And that level of shame caused me to leave New York. And I stayed out of New York for 2 years, went to Hawaii because it was halfway to Japan, because I could practice the art of sushi that I stole from Time Warner Moss at that point in my life. And it just kind of put things in perspective. And it's good to walk away. It's kind of like walking away from a project and then coming back from it. You know, so
coming
like,
back to it, yeah.
Yeah, like cooking, like, and working in New York was that project. And the whole you know, like, social scene that goes on, and the whole, you know, because we all... You know, whether we want to admit it or not, we do value other people's opinions. We care about what our bosses and what our peers think, you know, and to, you know, to, you just want to be comfortable where you're working.
Awesome. This is all of your zigs and zags.
It's too much.
Making my heart very happy. I want to end on this note, a shout out to your mother.
Mom.
Who is listening. Mom is listening right now. Hey, what's her name?
My mom's name is Sharon.
Sharon, I just sent her a text message, before the show, with the the Heritage Radio's web address, and so let's ground it to end. You're from New Jersey.
Yes.
At what point? How did you think? Okay, I want to do sushi. You start out with Chinese food. Your mom said something really key to you.
Yeah, I had asked my mom one day. She was a single mom and worked her ass off to raise me in a town that just cost way too much money. And as good towns usually do. And so, you know, I was like, Mom, can we have Chinese food tonight? And, you know, not realizing the financial, you know, perils we were in at the time. And she goes, you know, you want Chinese food, go work in a Chinese restaurant. And so I did. There was a Chinese restaurant like 2 blocks from our house. And I got a job, Puss in Pains, $5 hour. And then after that, I would make egg rolls and wontons when the sinks were clean. And the first time I had sushi, I saw a very happy man playing with knives and talking to people, making food. Three things I love to do, and I said, I want to do that.
Thank you so much, John Daly of New York Sushi Cove, for joining me this morning.
No, thank you very much for having me on.
Next week, we'll return to the program you've come to love and expect. We'll head to the Green Market with Chop champion Sean Scotese. Then welcome top chef Leah Cohen, and owner of Pig and Cow.
She is awesome.
In the studio. And then we'll wind it down with Matt Conway, GM and wine director of Marc Forgione Restaurant. This was Word of Mouth with Leyte Su at heritageradionetwork.org. Tweet at me at Leyte Su, and thanks so much for listening. Until next time, eat well, be swell.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.